15 days here, I have discussed subjects that I call sort of great issues that are at least great issues to me, and I think in some cases of great issue to you. In most of these, I have spoken from my experiences generally in the field of science and my scientific endeavor. Today, I make somewhat perhaps of a radical departure in this, because many of you may say that what's scientific about death? And this is a unique thing to be speaking of. But I thought, since this to me is quite a great issue, I thought it may be helpful to some of you to have me present some of my thoughts about death, which is really a compilation of the thoughts of many people as I examine this situation. I have entitled this, "A Stranger We Cannot Deny," to quote T.S. Eliot. I guess I could also call it incomprehensible, but not absurd. And this will become evident as I proceed. As has been my custom, I often read from George MacDonald. I have three readings from him today. The first is, "You will be dead as long as you refuse to die." The next, "We die daily. Happy those who daily come to life again." And the last, "All that is not God is death." A man asked a boy one day what he wanted to be when he grew up. And the boy thought for a while, and then he said, "I'd like to be alive." And as one surveys an uncertain and ominous future, it may be asking a great deal. Perhaps it is well now to describe death before I go any further. The definition of death is being revised because there are so many means available at the present time, and these means are increasing in number, as to keep someone sort of alive for an extended period of time. We used to have what we called the old man's friend, which was a respiratory distress and a pneumonia. We no longer let people die from the old man's friend. We put on, we install artificial kidneys, artificial hearts, or we keep the heart going. We pump in all kinds of fluids, and you really don't know when they die. And the recent redefinition of death has to do with determining death by an electroencephalogram. Perhaps it hasn't been fully defined as yet. And this is a great problem to many people. It has probably been wisely stated that neither the sun nor death can be looked on steadily for a very long time. And I believe this is true. Is Pastor Kruger here? I think his name is Kruger. He was here at least for a few days, and he's a chaplain, among other things, in the Children's Orthopedic in Seattle, where, among other things, they treat children with leukemia, which is most often a disease that doesn't last very long, but it's one of the great tragedies of our present time that we have not been able to face up to or do very much about, although there may be some breakthroughs in it in a not-too-distant future, but it's a very grim thing. And when you're caring for these children and their distraught parents day in and day out for an extended period of time, this is indeed a challenge, and it certainly proves this statement. So many of you may well ask, why talk about this in such a joyful place like Holden, and especially in a summer when we're talking about life, new life? I say to that that if you haven't got anything to say about death, you don't have really much to say about life either. In Augustine's words in his confession, he pled for a keener awareness of death, not because he wished to dull the thirst for life, but it's precisely for the opposite reason, to intensify self's awareness for life. In Seneca's words, no man enjoys the true taste of life but he who is willing and ready to quit it. It is tragic today that perhaps a majority are like the central figure in Albert Camus' book, The Stranger, which we discussed, when he said to the prison chaplain, in about the only emotion that he ever displayed, "I have little time left, and I am not going to waste it on God." That is the history of many people today. Generations of people whose history can be summed up in miles of blacktop, 1,000 lost golf balls, and split pins still standing after the last ball has been rolled down the alley. Whether it's on the road, on the golf course, or in the bowling alley, they try to escape for some moments from reality, when this constitutes most of their life, from what is stark reality that we're certainly, for everyone, all of us, this will all come to an end one day. I think it's something sort of spine-tingling about the last game in the World Series. And what makes it so is that there's no tomorrow. And that day will come to all of us. And to many people, it seems that everybody plays the game, but nobody wins. It's certainly true that death is a stranger we cannot deny, although there are many people who try to ignore it. And there's a lot of Buddhas around, or families of Gautama Buddha. In his youth, he lived in a very large house, essentially I think it was a palace, where for a time he was protected from all signs of decay. And before he was allowed in the garden, maids would be sent out to take away all the decaying flowers and the falling leaves, so he would be protected from all signs of suffering and death. But then one day he went out unattended, and he came to realize what we all have to realize, that this is a world of death. For he saw a dead man, and he was emotionally overcome, and he reacted really in spiritual violence. And it changed his whole life, and many millions, and the lives of many millions of his followers, they changed it into a vast pessimism. So what are we going to do about it? Americans often avoid discussions of death. And I'd like to read a little bit from, I think it's a fellow named Mendelssohn who quotes Max Lerner. And I think it probably sums up some of what we're trying to face here. "Whether through fear of emotional depths or because of drying up the sluices of religious intensity, the American avoids dwelling on death or even come to terms with it. He finds it morbid and recoils from it, surrounding it with words of avoidance. Americans never die, they pass away. And various taboos of speech and practice. A funeral parlor is decorated to look like a bank. Everything in a funeral ceremony is done in hushed tones, as if it were something furtive, to be concealed from the world. There is so much emphasis on being dignified that the ceremony often loses its quality of dignity. In some of the primitive cultures, there is difficulty in understanding the causes of death. It seems puzzling and even unintelligible. Living in a scientific culture, Americans have a ready enough explanation of how it comes, yet they show little capacity to come to terms with the fact of death itself and with the grief that accompanies it. We jubilate over birth and dance at weddings," says Margaret Mead, "but more and more hustle the dead off the scene without ceremony, without an opportunity for young and old to realize that death as much a fact of life as is birth. Our frantic accent on youth, Mendelssohn continues, our guilt and embarrassment about growing old are both reminders of our recoil from death. Yet there comes to all of us, as it must, the undeniable and inexorable here and now moment of dying. As Hermann Pfeiffel expresses it, the democracy of death encompasses us all. Now, enlightened man, I think, probably generally seeks not only what is true and what is beautiful, but I think we seek the permanent. And I think this is so well summed up in Pastor Hansen's little story about Halvor, the little Norwegian boy who lived with his parents and grandmother in Norway. His grandmother was very old and he dearly loved her. And one day she died. And Halvor was overcome with grief. In trying to comfort his son, the father obtained a small dog for him. And this dog became a very good friend and constant companion of Halvor. It slept in the same room with him and it always accompanied him at play. But in an unattended moment one day, a truck ran over the dog and it was killed instantly. Again, Halvor was overcome with grief. So his father purchased a canary for him. And Halvor became very attached to this canary. He would feed it, watch it bathe, and enjoy its song. And one morning, Halvor came downstairs. And the bird was no longer singing, for it was lying at the bottom of the cage, dead. He again was overcome with grief as he went to his father and fell at his feet and threw his arms around his legs and looked up to his father and said, "Far, gimme nogo som vi aldrig dö." Father, give me something that will never die. This, I think, expresses probably the wishes of many people. In scientific circles today, we hear a lot about producing life in the laboratory. But the real concern for any living man is probably not the production of life, but how to retain life. The death of death is man's greatest need. And it might also add probably his greatest hope. The Christian believes in the death of death. This belief is incomprehensible, but it is not absurd, and it is devoutly desired. Death is defeated through death itself, and it is revealed to us only by God, and is accomplished through death itself, the death of the Son of God. And because of this death, we can no longer equate to life as the ultimate statistic that is cited by George Bernard Shaw, which he infers when he said, "One out of one dies." You see, he equates then life with death. Death is not the final answer, for sin and death are defeated and have met their own end in a death, a very special death. When Jesus said, "It is finished," that did it. Many of you have wondered, as I mentioned earlier, why we talk about death when our theme is life, new life. And just this death of death, which I have just spoken of, that is the one great act that allows us to celebrate life, new life. So that the ultimate statistic then is not one out of one dies, but one died for all. For it answers well the question posed by Job: if a man die, will he rise again? I think that probably Oswald Hoffman, who has addressed this subject on many occasions, expresses it better than I can. He says, if a man die, shall he live again? A real question asked by real men in a real world receives its real answer from a real God who achieved a real victory over the grave, which all of us know to be real. I am here to tell you that if life is real and if death is real, then this really happened. One man came, was born, lived, and died. And ever since, everything has been different. The facts are there for every intelligent man to see. Not only did Jesus Christ die, but he rose from the dead with a glory people did not know he had. This man was God, speaking to men and acting for men. This is no illusion. The early Christians did not create these stories about the resurrection of Christ. It was the stories that created the Christian hope, sustaining millions of people down through the centuries and carrying people along even to today. It was not the love of his followers, but the power of God that raised Jesus Christ from the dead. On another occasion, he said these words, "The resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead has made all the difference in the world. In Christ, the risen and living Lord, you can have peace." The climax of the whole story is the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. After that, anything could happen. After that, everything did happen. A new age was born, a new faith came into being, a new spirit entered the world. And with this knowledge, then, and this belief, this faith that Carol spoke so well of this morning, what do we do about it? We must do something about it. We must tell others of the death of death and live in the assurance of this fact. It is our place then to minister to the bereaved, to the dying, and perhaps we can spend a little time on what to do about the dying. And I will turn again to an account that was recorded by a fellow named Mendelssohn, and it really appeared in a little publication called Omega in December of 66, which is a newsletter from the Cushing Hospital in Framingham, Massachusetts. In this edition, Dr. Charles Ehring tells of a letter he received from his son working as a clinical clerk in a hospital ward. And the young man described his first experience with death of a patient. "I had my first patient today, a very good man, 83, without anyone at his bedside, nurse or friend to help him. He was one of those unusual people whom you never forget. He came to our ward on Saturday morning and was put in the only empty bed of four. Beside him was a truck driver. Diagonally sat a proud, self-educated poet. Directly across lay a laborer. It was a room of four proud men. Occasionally, as best they could, the three would look to the newcomer's needs, but he appreciated far more their company, for he would listen to them, though he did not enter into the flow of talk. He was the sick one, they knew, and they would ask quietly about him during our less urgent ministrations to them. When the old man's condition worsened, he was moved by the nurses to a single room where the frequent visit of doctors to his bedside would not awaken the other patients. Of course, they were not asked. They were never party to these arrangements. He immediately asked me to return to his old room. Most important to him was the comfort he derived from being with people. I promised this would be done as soon as he was seen by the surgeon. And when I drew blood for tests, he again quietly asked if he could return to the old room. And again, I assured him that he would be soon returned. Mid-afternoon Monday, x-rays were taken. He was becoming shorter of breath, and I propped him up against the pillows. The nurses were not about. I returned to give him intravenous medication. He'd become even more short of breath, but found some relief when I elevated the head of his bed. A last time, he asked if he would be able to find a place for him in his old room. I told him he would have to wait only a little longer, but thought, if only I could take you there now. But the surgeons had not yet seen him, and as I passed by his door, I saw that he had slipped down in bed. I went in and reached over the bed rail to help him onto his pillow, but there was no need of it. He had died alone, denied what he most wanted, the unspoken comfort of people, any people around him." Dr. Ehring then comments on his son's letter. "As I cogitated this report, moved and proud of the principal characters, I thought the patient died with what dignity he could muster and with my son's respect and humanity. He wanted of his friends and familiar surroundings, new though they were, and they should have been imperative and taken precedence over any and all technical matters. My guess is that he had the other three patients. Had the other three patients been consulted, they would have wanted it too. How slavish has become our worship of the great God routine, as the human and most especially the humane are counted for less than the machine. I am reminded of A.E. Housman's. I see in many an eye that measures me the mortal sickness of a mind too unhappy to be kind. The artist gives way to the technician in an area of scientism. One of the great regrets, I think, of my life is that I could not be at my father's bedside when he died on January 20th. I was at Princeton at the time. I did not know that he was critically ill, and I received the call, as we all will someday. This happened to be at 11 o'clock at night, and found that he had already died without the family present. I say that it may, that in hopes that you may not have those regrets. So we as Christians must help lend dignity to what is probably life's most dramatic moment.
One line at the end of that quote there, the artist must give way to the
technician in the age of scientism.
The important thing is that everything is done in a routine.
Yeah.
People have had everyone in the hospital, you know how you have cut it.
Yeah. It's a great issue today, and it's a very difficult one. Now I'd like to turn from this. I know this thing will seem sort of patchy today, but I just recalled something that I decided to include in here, because yesterday the physicians and some of the others, we discussed this, of how one should, what one should tell the dying one. We want the truth. Of course, in the Arab culture, this is not done. And there are several reasons for this, but I thought it may be of interest to you to hear one man's view. I'm not saying it's my view, but I thought it would be of some value for thought. This happens to be a professor of internal medicine at American University at Beirut in Lebanon, about telling the truth to the patient and family. The truth will make you free. This statement often applies more to the person who talks the truth rather than to the person to whom the truth is conveyed. The truth, in the context of your question, is very hot soup. It must be blown over and cooled before most people can swallow it without burning their mouth. Assuming that the truth is irrefutably documented, it needs a great deal of tact in imparting it to the concerned. In 1933, I had the good fortune of discussing truth with Adler, and was impressed by his remark that one should not stab into truth. What may gush out might be destructive. Do not take for granted that relatives can stand the truth better than the patient. Often the patient does not resort to direct questioning, although he's fairly aware of the situation, in order to spare himself and the physician. What must be said to the patient and relatives in such situations cannot be bought in a ready-to-wear store. It must be tailored individually, and I think this requires much prayer. Myself, when confronted with the problem, I discussed it once with the intelligent among the concerned and avoid harping on it from then on. Three important don'ts in this man's opinion. Don't tell old parents that their child is doomed. I have seen them lose their minds. Don't read about the disease from a text, neither to patient nor to relatives. Don't cut off the hope in nature's healing process. I am reminded of a very intelligent young woman who suffered for years from an incurable disease. And one day during one of my visits, I told her that after all, medicine had its limitations. Her response was, "Doctor, we are good friends. Don't tell any of your other patients what you told me today. Patients are not interested in your limitations. Patients expect hope and courage from you." I assume this question Now, on the perception of imminent death by patient and family, I assume this question relates to the patient who is an extremist, that is, dying. Fortunately, often the patient himself is unconscious. The family probably have realized the gravity of the situation. Here also I have a few remarks. Keep the light of hope alive in cases of acute illnesses, because no matter how grave the situation may appear, it may be reversible. A dignified attitude on the part of professional attendants in the presence of the dying and the dead, and avoid predicting the hour of demise. Now, a lot of them say, well, why do you Christians grieve if you have such great hope? I think it is right that we should grieve because we love so much. Elner wrote a letter to me when we were discussing or corresponding regarding my letter, my contribution to the Courier. And she has had experience in this. And she said that God has provided us as Christians with such a full and satisfying life here on earth with Christ that it's hard to give up any piece of it, although actually it isn't ours. And we are often reminded, and I think especially as men, we hesitate to cry, you know. I mean, this is so unmanly. Yet Jesus did weep at the graveside and at the bedside of his friends, unashamedly. And it has a cleansing effect, I think, a great relief to do this. And then we as Christians, too, must be concerned with those who grieve, not only in our prayers, but to call on them. And again, I turn to a letter from Elner when she was writing on hearing of my father's death. My thoughts have been with you this past week. Somehow we always seem to get through the first few days all right because there is so much to be attended to, but then there often descends a vacuum left by the departed one. And this is true. I mean, we run over and call on the person the day after the death, and then we forget them. This we must not do.
There's a real depth in that love idea too. I think they're on grief for the Christian, because the Christians need to assert dogmatically and apologetically at this point in the world in their mourning. And these have really become persons to them.
Yeah.
Tennessee Williams says in one of his plays, which is back in the library, and I read aloud when I bought it at the Seattle store, that big one, Nielsen and whatever it's called, but they all act as though ain't it the truth. I mean, most people are bound together by wanting to outlive the other so they get moved, not by love. And for them, death, though it has perhaps a social indication, you can't be like them, shown not so free. After you observe humanity, you're free, and now you no longer have to envy your widow of friends who enjoy the rule without having to take care of the guy who got it. I mean, I was in the TV program in Detroit on 131.8, it was startling that most men after 50 are very content with the wife they have. They have no desire to wander. It's the wife that's tired, and she's waiting until death to meet her, and envying the widow of friends. Well, if this is the world in which we live, how can we mean the same? You're tied to each other, identified. Jim Messer gave us his book, brought up a mean argument about why we're Christians more and more than others. Because they really miss each other. They really do. I mean, a part of them has simply been wrenched. And it's like if you preach in prison camp all the time, you can escape suffering. Nobody has to suffer. We all got affliction, pain, and we can't. Here we are. We're all starving. This is part of it. All you have to do to keep from suffering is not look at the other person who's starving. Suffering is what involves the other person. And this is what the Christian does. And this has been very clear in our churches, our teaching, or from our doctors, or to our doctors. And I think, you know how, I get something like Al, when Al lost Paul.
Yeah.
How is he doing?
Yeah, yeah.
I said, like a man.
Yeah.
Supposed to take it like a leader in a church. Supposed to be in the pulpit next Sunday morning, everybody glories on another man who lost his son similarly. In the sermon preached, though nothing happened that Sunday morning. This was great. This was real. You know, do we get over it? I don't think we do. We learn to live. This is what I tell them.
Right.
I certainly have not gotten over my father. The guy in the middle of the left. That's the left. You're mixed together. Peculiar sense as Christians, and this needs to be said. Christianity is no and adding more grief in this situation of a different kind. We don't sorrow a little bit more whole.
That's right.
Life is a different quality entirely.
I was hoping you'd bring this in. And my thoughts go to Al Rodness. We discussed this subject on my first trip to Heart Lake at our first lay seminar in September. It's the most memorable trip I've ever made almost anywhere. And he and I walked up to view Heart Lake. And we discussed this subject. And it's sort of summarized in these words here. That the one who is taken, the one who is gone, seems to invade the mind the more. Perhaps it is because in this strange company, we are at one with those who are gone. And those are really Al's words. But the ache and the emptiness is there, for we are so fiercely tied to the touch of a hand, a gleam in the eye, and the sound of a voice. And I think Al Rodness has been a great comfort to me in this, and as he has been to many people. And relative to his son Paul, who's then an Oxford scholar, and I'll never forget when he visited me in my place of business at Richland about, I imagine, 8 years ago or more. And when Carol talks about this, he talks with a great feeling because Paul was just like a son to him, and he preached the funeral sermon for Paul. And it's probably the most difficult one he probably had to preach, I don't know. But at that time, among his sons, Al Rodness told me about son Paul, and he was looking forward for his homecoming, for he was scheduled for a big homecoming, but he never quite made it, for another homecoming intervened. And Al Rodness explains it in one of the most beautiful eulogies probably that was ever written. And it was so impressive to me that I sent it to C.S. Lewis in a letter, and because his son Paul had spent an afternoon with him. And C.S. Lewis wrote back that he was most impressed with this. And it goes like this. He was only 24. He had been center on the football team, steersman on the crew. Childhood, high school, Christian College, Oxford. The years had mounted upward in a spiraling crescendo. In George MacDonald's words, he was a gleam-faced, pure-eyed, strong-willed, high-hearted boy, and the rising plateaus were before him. Suddenly, his youth, his life was ended. The roar of a motor, a broken body on a city street. Youth is not a preparation for life. Youth is life itself. There is no time for rehearsal. The great play is on. Every day is another little block of time in which to live. To live, to love, to serve, to weep, to laugh. You cannot employ today only to set the stage for tomorrow. For there may be no tomorrow. Long years ago, a youth of 33 writhed to his death on a cross. Across the centuries, this young man summons other young men and women to join him and to give him the vibrant, aspiring years of their youth. These years may be the only ones that can be given, for there may be no more. And what years they are. Exuberant, gay, warm, sensitive, strong years. And if the Lord can have these years, then he has captured the best. Perhaps these are enough for him. You may have 70 to give him. You may have but 104. However long or short, having given him your years, when death makes his capricious attack, the Lord of the cross and the empty grave will set you on your feet again and put you to work in the imperishable sectors of his kingdom. Now we have talked a bit about how we handle grief. Now what about for ourselves? And my prayer, the prayer I leave with you, is that we may be like Simeon, who could say, "Now let thy servant depart in peace, for mine eyes have seen thy salvation. Or may we emulate Polycarp, the bishop of Smyrna, in the very early days of the Christian church. He was over 80 years old, and in the persecution of Christians that was taking place, he was a victim of it. He was a much loved and much revered man, not only by Christians but others. And many of them who were not Christians wished to save his life, and they said, all you have to do is deny your Lord and you will be saved. But he chose not to deny his Lord, who had been his friend all these years and who had done him no wrong. And so they burned him at the stake. And as the flames started to encircle him, he looked heavenward and said, I thank thee that thou hast found me worthy of this day and hour. May we be similarly worthy. We must live as if we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the skies. We must, because we have. I will close with a brief prayer and a benediction. Almighty Lord, may we face today with power, tomorrow with courage, and eternity with confidence, because thou art glorified in us. And then may the Lord bless thee with the gladness that knoweth no decay, with the riches that cannot pass away, with the sunshine that makes an endless day. Thus may he bless thee and keep thee with the all-covering shadow of his wings, with the strong love that guards from evil things, with the sure power that safe to glory brings. Thus may he keep thee. Amen.